Brothers, W. E. Garner was a physical chemist who had written on radiation. I used to quote his research results to show that chemiluminescent radiation associated with the reaction of CO or hydrogen to make CO2 or water was not the source of the radiation in a furnace, but it was the CO2 and water vapor that produced plain thermal radiation that were important. Garner studied chemiluminescent radiation, and he could measure it in the presence of something that would swamp it by quenching thermal radiation in order to pick up chemiluminescence. So I knew that name by reputation, and Fred, one of his brothers, got the OBE from the British government for his work on fire warfare during that critical period when we weren't in the war yet and we thought Germany was going to attack England at any time. England was wholly deficient militarily, and figured that oil was about the only weapon they had. And Fred Garner had helped them design things like the fugas, a barrel of oil put into a roadside on a road that they thought a German tank would be coming along, with an explosive to throw out and ignite 55 gallons of oil thrown out ahead of the tank or on the tank. And he had studied oil defense against landing at the beachheads in the south of England. Another brother, I forget what the other brother was in, but he was knighted. The three Garner brothers were important people, and Fred was head of chemical engineering at the University of Birmingham. And in America, on Standard Oil invitation, to tell us what they knew about flamethrowers and incendiary bombs and what we should be doing. And I had a lot of time with Fred, and he became a very close, warm friend. I may get back to him later. Now, why did I digress to the Garners? I've lost track of the point I was making when I got off on the Garners. It was Standard Oil Company's intense devotion to helping to win the war, and the enormous contrast between my knowledge of how real that was and how much sleep Bob Russell was losing about what the best things were to do, and people's view that the reason the oil company was in the war was to sell oil. I don't know how much of that belongs in this
thing. Well, we worry about that later. Did you work on the incendiary bombs as well as flamethrowers?
Well, I decided that we didn't know enough about this radiation problem that Langmuir and I had talked about at this meeting at Harvard before Pearl Harbor. That meeting was 4 or 5 months before Pearl Harbor. Yeah. Expectation of trouble, no magnesium and no oil, and a discussion of incendiarism. I thought we ought to measure how much radiation it takes to start a fire on wood. Gordon Wilkes was head of the heat measurements lab I was full-time on my war direction research, so I couldn't run anything. I went to Gordon and told him that I would design a radiator and make the calculation of how much the radiation was, and he could run the experiments in his lab. And he was happy to do that, and we had a rectangular set of Canthal ribbons, high temperature, electric resistance furnace. We also had a set of glow bars behind a mask, a known source of radiation at a known temperature, and knowing how far it was to the target, we knew the intensity of the radiation on the wood, and we would find how many seconds it took in continuous radiation to start fire, starting with different intensities, and the total impulse, the product of intensity by time, of course, varied with the intensity level. And we had both piloted and unpiloted ignition. The unpiloted ignition, just straight irradiation until you got fire. But if you had just a tiny bead of a gas flame, so that when something that was combustible started coming out of the wood, it took a lot less radiation to start things. So we had good quantitative measurements of piloted and unpiloted ignition. And that moved on to moisture control in the wood. We started keeping the wood samples in sealed garbage pails, metal cans, of known humidity, and finding what the effect of humidity was on this impulse needed. And when we got thickened fuels, among the things we measured was the integral of the radiation from a half-pound gob of jellied gasoline set fire to, if you assume that the radiation was uniformly distributed on a sphere, you find out how much energy, how much of the heat of combustion of the fuel was available to you as radiation at the wood. It was the order of 30%. So we had a lot of this data on ignition. The chief contracts for bomb development were with Standard Oil of New Jersey. Under a man named Myers, with two very key men under Myers, Knox and Rickards, and they did the excellent development work on the cloth tail, nothing but a bandage, a gauze bandage stowed in the tail of the bomb that came out and dragged the bomb down. Now, I can talk about details of incendiary bombing for quite a while, should I?
That's up to you. If you wish
got
to continue,
the time, if you want to take the time, I'm in the mood to
go ahead.
All right,
then why don't we do that?
It.
I have plenty of tapes of it.
Oh. We had Standard of New Jersey had decided that an attic eaves test was the best test of incendiary bomb performance. I should go back of that and say that before Standard got into it, before Jersey got into it, Louis Fieser at Harvard was building little structures and putting thickened fuels under them to find out how much fuel it took to light these pieces of wood. And he'd already done some of that when Limier and I were talking at this early Harvard meeting, but not very much. And as soon as we had an organized group, we had a contract with Harvard Fieser to work on these thickeners. He had a thickener that involved naphthenic and palmitic and stearic acids, insoluble aluminum soaps of them. And he named it napalm, naphthenic and palmitic. That name was invented early. The composition changed a lot. The composition is entirely different today, but the name is still there. So that name napalm came out of the early work of Section 11.3 on World War II. The use of fire to win World War II is quite a bit different, to my conscience, from the use of fire to drop on the natives of Vietnam. And fire people are judged by the latter activity rather than the first. Jersey had developed this A-framed attic structure, two by fours this way and that way, and a few boards laid over and a few on the floor, and then you throw a bomb into it. And they early developed this concept that better than a magnesium bomb, which had to drop where there was something to light, if you had a bomb that dropped with a time delay fuse so that it was allowed to then lie down on its side and then blow out the end, a jet of stuff, that stuff had a chance of hitting something that was ignitable. You covered enormously more ground than you did with a magnesium bomb. And this was Jersey's concept. They worked very hard on it. By the spring of 1942, they had worked so hard that they had a supply of these things made pretty much by hand at Standard Oil of New Jersey with a canning machine and hand folding and so on. Of bombs that we decided we needed to test. The Army wanted, and the Air Force, I guess they weren't separate then, I don't remember, wanted evidence that this bomb was good news from the air. So we went out in the summer of 42 to have our first airborne tests of incendiary bombs at the new Jefferson Proving Grounds of Army Ordnance, some farmland and a small town in Indiana, not far from Madison, Indiana, had been taken over. This included a deconsecrated Catholic church and some stores and a banker's home and some chicken coops and pig pens and various things that we went out to bomb from 1,500 feet with our supply of homemade, almost homemade incendiary bombs. Well, bomb sighting wasn't good. And worst of all, the percentage coverage of a rural area with combustible stuff is minute. It's 2 or 3%. It's not a city. It's not even a town. It's a country. Once in a while, a rail fence would catch fire, and once a barn caught fire, and once we had a bomb actually land in a banker's house, and one near in the churchyard. But the assessment was very indifferent. We were housed at some inn where there was a ground floor restaurant, and a sacroiliac thing hit me. I couldn't get out of bed. I fell on the floor and I was nearly an hour getting down to the basement, at which time they were all ready to go off to work and picked me up and carried me back upstairs and brought a doctor out from the proving grounds, military doctor, to strap me up. My father had died and been buried 50 miles from there just a few months before. While I was strapped up and unable to participate, I did painfully go in a taxi to my father's grave, and then back to work. I was out, I think, 2 or 3 days of that test. Well, the test didn't really get us anywhere. But it made us think we were much in need of a proof that we had a good bomb. And we got into production with the Nuadex company on napalm. They revised the formula of napalm. Caesar's napalm was really not any good, but Nuadex chemicals was. And that isn't fair. It was good, but it wasn't good by standards of something that would store and still be a jelly after months of storage or some heat or cold. So a lot of work went into napalm.
Did Fieser continue work on napalm even when you went to Nuadex?
Yes, he continued. Well, by... Now I'm guessing, but I'm pretty sure that it was the late summer of 42 when we had a big meeting at the Bayway plant of Standard Oil. To decide what fillings to specify for a large-scale manufacture of the bomb. And by this time, this was before Nuadex got into the act. There was Louis Fieser's napalm. There was S.O. applesauce, which was the name we had given to a sodium soap that Standard Oil Development had used, making it the way they made grease. And it looked more like applesauce than it did like clear jelly. And there was Eastman's Kodak's ground-up newsprint. And we expected to have three contestants. And the judges of which was right, there were three judges. I was one, Earl Stevenson was one, and Roger Adams, who was a top He was the number two man in NDRC, the organic chemist from Illinois, next to Conant in NDRC, was there. And we had three generals there as visitors. And a great many technical people. And a fourth one showed up. DuPont had a methyl methacrylate thickened gel. There was a lot of bitterness between Pfizer and the Esso people. And Earl Stevenson and I were wondering how we're going to make this diplomatic choice. The newsprint isn't going to be any good. And we never heard of this methacrylate filler. So it's Esso applesauce and napalm. And neither one is as good as it ought to be, but we're going to have to pick one of them. There were many kinds of tests set up. One, the thing was put in a acetone dry ice mixture and cooled down to the bomb bay of a high-flying airplane. And that was one of the tests. And one of the tests was on dispersion. One was slamming it against something hard. And there were several variations on this fire starting in the attic. Esso had done a superb job of making all the tests they could think of that everybody was to go through. And I'm going to tell a story that I'm going to take off the record later. Louis Pfizer had an assistant, Hirschberg, and when Pfizer's bomb was Pfizer's filling was demonstrated, there was an ignition failure, and Pfizer loudly said something implying that Esso had rigged it to make it fail, and then found out that Hirschberg had not connected the wires. Hirschberg was so afraid of Louis Pfizer's domineering person that he did not have the strength to speak up and straighten out the situation. But Esso learned about it, and everybody before the meeting was over knew about it by whisperings. But Louis had never apologized, nor had Hirschberg spoken up after their ugly denouncement of Esso as having rigged the test. To our great surprise and to the pleasure of Earl Stevenson and me, DuPont's methacrylate looked better than napalm or Esso applesauce, and we decided the bomb should be filled with methacrylate. Now, later on, the Nuodex Chemical Company's work on napalm put another napalm, not the Pfizer one, back into the picture, and methacrylate finally bowed out, but it went into a great many tens of thousands of bombs. I don't know how many. Now we had a supply that could be tested on a significant scale. The Doolittle raid had occurred in Tokyo, based on the belief that the Japanese were afraid of fire. The Japanese knew a lot more about handling fire than we did.
Did that raid use the DuPont material, or was that the original napalm?
No, that the Doolittle raid was not with that. The Doolittle raid was before we had these bombs. The Doolittle, I'll come to that point. The Doolittle raid was with the M57, I think, was the number. The thermite bomb of the chemical corps, not thermite. Thermite was thermite with some extra oxidant in it. And it had a striking velocity, which put it right through the house and buried it in the ground. And we were convinced that the Doolittle raid had done absolutely nothing with those thermite bombs. We knew enough about bombing to know that the thermite bomb was no good, and the chemical corps had accepted our conclusion that it was no good, and were with us on having to bring a bomb down to a proper striking velocity. We had airborne, we had wind tunnel tests on the cloth tail bomb. We had a mortar set up at Factory Mutual. That's a New England fire research group. They had a big place out in Norwood, and they set up an overhead crane that could inject a bomb at striking velocity into a simulated house room. And we had a lot of tests in full rooms of single houses, furnished rooms. We bought all the second-hand furniture we could find in the Boston area and put it in these rooms. And Factory Mutual was doing other fire tests. We had them on fire warfare. We had them on flamethrowers. Sadly, we had them on saving pigs. I forget the name of the pig, skin of which was most like the human animal. Cheshire pigs that had been unsuccessfully used in tests out The Cheshire Pig story is a post-war story. Forget that. That's a post-war story. Part of the Cheshire Pig was post-war. Part of it was wartime story at Factory Mutual. The part I started to tell, I shouldn't tell because it was post-war. Well, again, Standard Oil were the group who said the only way to convince the military that we've got a good bomb is a very realistic test. These generals don't believe what scientists do. They only believe what they think they can visualize. We've got to build a Japanese village and a German village, and the Dugway Proving Ground of the Chemical Corps in Utah is a place where we can do it. And Slim Myers of Standard Oil Development, called Slim, he weighed about 230, was the driving force for this. He had no trouble selling it to our section. We knew he was right. And so we supported all of his activity. They had a big contract to do design work. They got the Army Corps of Engineers into the act. They brought Mendelssohn, 18 years of architectural experience in Tokyo, to specify what Japanese houses contained. They got, what did I call him? Mendelssohn was the German specialist on German construction. And a man with a French name was the specialist on Japan.